I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a recent UCLA survey, 75% of all students said they were searching for some meaning or purpose in their lives. Well, thousands of other students are finding just that at religious colleges, which are expanding at breakneck speed in the U.S., according to the author of the new book, God on the Quad. We'll talk with her in a moment about what's being called the new missionary generation of college students. But first, a congressional check-in. The Senate has spent several days in acrimonious debate over a bankruptcy bill that would make it more difficult for consumers to dissolve their credit card debt. Amendments to the bill, including allowing the elderly to hold on to their homes and protecting people facing massive medical bills, were defeated. Another amendment to protect servicemen whose personal businesses fail after long deployments was also voted down. Other news on the Hill today, a bill to reverse the military's don't ask, don't tell policy, and a shift in social security. Maybe. Joining us from Capitol Hill with the latest is Roll Call senior staff writer Mark Preston. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with that bankruptcy bill. As we said, the Democrats tried a number of amendments, ones we mentioned, and another that would prohibit abortion protesters from filing bankruptcy. Explain that one.
Democrats don't want to make it any easier for abortion protesters to file for bankruptcy if they're sued for their actions outside clinics and for other things.
Because in filing for bankruptcy, these protesters were then avoiding fines.
Would avoid fines or having to pay out damages for any of their actions. So obviously that has been a hot potato for the last couple of years. You know, another amendment that we could see today, actually, Robin, is Ted Kennedy's effort to try to raise the minimum wage on this bill. It's something that Kennedy has been pushing for a number of years. He wants to raise the minimum wage, which is right now $5.15 an hour, up to $7.25. Republicans are expected to counter that and try to raise it only $1.10. So there will be a fight over that today as well.
Well, we mentioned also that the Democrats tried to protect people with huge health bills. A study in the journal Health Affairs showed that half of all U.S. bankruptcies are caused by health bills. But the Republicans, in response, said, first of all, they didn't believe that statistic. And secondly, this is not a bill about insurance. It's about bankruptcy.
Basically, what Republicans are going to say that even if you do build up health bills, if you have the ability to repay them back, you should repay them back just because you have gained a lot of debt because of having to go to the doctor or the hospital or whatnot. That shouldn't preclude you from having to pay your bills.
Well, the core of the argument over bankruptcy seems to be between credit card companies and consumer groups. Can you explain that?
Well, basically, credit card companies, their argument has been that it's very easy for you, me, or anyone to run up a lot of debt and then at the end of the day say, look, I can't pay for this anymore. I'm not able to do so. File for bankruptcy and just absolve themselves of it other than having, you know, a mark on their record. Consumer groups are saying that, you know, basically the credit card companies are just making money off the backs of the consumers. For instance, one of the amendments that failed would have required the credit card companies to tell consumers how much it would cost for them to pay off a credit card bill if they were to pay a minimum payment. The credit card companies will say that people put themselves in this situation and that they should stand up for what they've done. I mean, they should be held accountable for it.
Moving away from the bankruptcy bill, we have a group of 50 House members, all but one who are Democrats, trying to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law that allows gays and lesbians to serve in the military only if they don't reveal their sexual orientation. What are these people saying in defense of their bill?
Supporters are saying that it should be passed and that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy should be repealed because given what we're facing now with our homeland security concerns, with our concerns of going overseas, that more and more people are being forced out of the armed services because of their sexual orientation. And the backers of this bill think that that's absolutely ridiculous. But having said that, I don't think it's going to go anywhere in this Congress.
In fact, a GAO report says that up to 300 foreign language specialists have been removed because of the sexual orientation, and that it's cost taxpayers about $200 million to retrain for those positions.
Yeah, but opponents to that will say it's not about money, it's about values. Opponents of this bill are going to say that the country is becoming more and more conservative. It's something that they'll point back to the last election and say, look what's happened across the country. People don't want gays and lesbians serving in the military. In fact, you might not even see a hearing on this bill this year.
Well, brief mention on Social Security. There are some signals coming from the White House that indicate that the mounting negative reaction to the president's plan might be having an effect. Treasury Secretary John Snow indicating yesterday that the White House might consider some alternatives. What are you hearing on the Hill about this?
The president's proposal is in trouble. There's no question about that. There's some thought that the president went out there and offered up this grand scheme about how to overhaul the Social Security system without really putting putting out a firm proposal, perhaps leaving it to the Hill to find all the details on it. Basically, on the Hill right now, what you're going to see is you're going to see congressional Republicans, both on the House and in the Senate, try to find their way through this and try to come up with some kind of alternative. They're very fearful politically that this is going to hurt them in 2006 if they're not able to come up with some kind of plan in 2005.
Mark Preston, senior staff writer for Roll Call. He joined us from Capitol Hill. Mark, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Enrollment at the over 100 member institutions of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities jumped 60% in the last decade. Utah-based Brigham Young University has opened an Idaho and a Hawaii branch. What's going on? And who are the 1.3 million students graduating every year from over 700 religious colleges in the U.S.? Reporter Naomi Schaefer Riley set out to answer these questions, and the result is her new book, God on the Quad: How Religious Colleges and the Missionary Generation Are Changing America. And Naomi joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's talk about the students first. You write that they are, by and large, red through and through. Did they strike you as being the same, though?
No, not at all. I visited 20 colleges of all different denominations. I went to some evangelical, some Mormon, some Jewish, even a Buddhist college. And I think that there are some, you know, similarities among them. They all do feel that faith has a legitimate place in public life and politics. But I think their views on political, cultural issues do vary quite a bit from school to school.
What do you mean by red through and through then?
Well, I think, you know, what's happened is essentially we associate red states now with, I think, people who are where religion affects more parts of their lives, where they feel it's appropriate for religion to come into their professional life or into the classroom, for instance, when you're talking about education. And in that sense, I think that I'd call them red. You know, when you're talking about proportionally, they are certainly more likely to vote Republican. You know, certainly many of them voted for George Bush. And, you know, certainly as a college population, that's pretty unusual.
And universally, they all seem more motivated to study.
Yeah, I was actually surprised by this. You know, I talked to a lot of professors who had taught previously at secular colleges, and I said, you know, what's the biggest difference academically? And they said, you know, looking at students, you know, on similar intellectual levels, they said, you know, the students here almost all pass in their work, and they come to class every time we hold class. And I think,
oddly enough.
I know. I mean, when you're talking to people outside of higher education, they think that's kind of a low bar. But, you know, the students are very, very motivated. They have a sense of purpose. They know exactly why they're in college. And so they really want to show up to every class and pass in their work.
Let's focus on a couple of the schools. I have to ask, because this is so fascinating, a Buddhist college?
Yeah, it's called Soka University. It's in Southern California in Aliso Viejo. The Buddhist school is sort of, you know, playing around a lot with its identity. I think they really want to focus on human rights and sort of some universal values. So they're trying to figure out exactly how much of the school should be specifically Buddhist and how much should be about these more universal values. Hmm. But about half the students are Buddhist.
Hmm. Well, you also went to a school that's very much in the news, Bob Jones, the Fundamentalist Christian University in Greenville, South Carolina. It had a ban on interracial dating. It's made the university quite media shy. So how close could you get to the school?
You know, surprisingly, I had quite a bit of access to campus. I spent about 4 days on campus. The students and the faculty are certainly very media shy. They feel as if they've been burned a few too many times.
Tell us some of the other issues that's put them in the news.
Well, you know, aside from the interracial dating ban, you know, they've also said things about Catholics, which I don't think come off too kindly. They've called the Pope the Antichrist.
Well, there you go.
I mean, these are not things that tend to go over well in the media. They dropped the interracial dating ban recently. You know, they're clearly trying to move forward, but they're so isolated in a way that it's hard for them to really understand, I think, in many ways, how the media operates. So, for instance, you know, one of the things I could not get access to while I was there was the student handbook, you know, mm-hmm. where most schools just post all their rules on the website. At Bob Jones, you know, they said, well, you can ask us questions about the rules, but we won't actually tell you them, you know. We'll give you the answers if you sort of guess. I have to say that none of the students tried to convert me. I myself am Jewish, and I sort of figured walking around the Bob Jones campus that someone would try to proselytize to me. And the dean of students did, but none of the students did.
What did
themselves.
He say to you?
Well, he almost felt sorry for me, you know. So he said, you know, I see here from your resume, it says you know Hebrew. He said, are you of the Jewish persuasion? And I said yes. And he said, well, you know, we love the Jews, you know, which is a very common theme that you get among evangelicals and fundamentalists, you know, that they talk about, you know, their connection that they feel with the Jewish people and Israel. And he said, you know, I just hope you use your time here, you know, to come to Jesus, or, you know, something to that effect. And, you know, there was no hellfire and brimstone, which is sort of more what I expected. You know, you're dangling over the fiery pits and don't you realize it? So, you know, the strategy has changed a little, I think, in that respect.
Right. But, it just points to, you wouldn't go and write on, you know, any other university but a evangelical university and have them ask you to come to Jesus during the course of the interview.
In fact, you know, of the 20 schools I went to, that single incident with the dean of Bob Jones was the only one where someone explicitly tried to talk to me about my own personal faith.
Well, you write that, staying with Bob Jones for a moment, you write that for Bob Jones students, religion defines politics. What do you mean?
Well, you know, they draw a very direct link, I think, between the things that they see in the Bible. And I should make a distinction here between the fundamentalist and the evangelical schools. You know, a school like Bob Jones really does take a biblically literal, you know, reading. And so, you know, everything they read in the Bible has a direct correlation in politics.
So what are the kids like?
Well, I think the kids, you know, are primarily sheltered. I mean, I would say that that's basically the biggest thing. You know, it used to be that a lot of kids going to Bob Jones were coming out of public school. But now almost 90% of the students have either gone to a fundamentalist Christian school all the way through or are homeschooled. Mm-hmm. And so they really don't understand even what the outsider's view is. You know, there is a strategy going on at Bob Jones. They want to give students what they call a liberal arts education. So they teach you Shakespeare and, you know, they send you to classical music concerts and all these things that you wouldn't expect at kind of a backwater fundamentalist institution. But they want their students to be prepared to go to cosmopolitan America and convert people in New York City. The only problem is I think the students are too scared of people in New York City to ever try that.
Well, speaking of New York City, you went to Yeshiva University in New York. You call this chapter the Hatfields and the McCoys. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a school that's very much divided. You know, as a student at Yeshiva and the undergraduate division, you enroll separately in the rabbinical part of the school and in the undergraduate secular college. And the faculties of those two different institutions seem to be in a war with each other. The secular faculty think religion is sort of a backward kind of waste of time, and they don't really know why the students are devoting their energies to it. And the secular faculty are hired completely without regard to the religious mission of the school. And many of the far right-wing rabbis, and I use the term right-wing not politically here, but more theologically, you know, those they don't understand what the value of a liberal arts education is at all. They think, well, you know, you could also do manual labor. As long as you earn a living and have time to study Torah, you know, why would you waste your time with English and, you know, history, that sort of thing.
And I'm wondering, do you think that the split in the school mirrors a division in the Jewish community post-college?
Well, I mean, you're still only talking about Orthodox Jews who are actually the students at the school. But I think that there is certainly a split between sort of more secularized Jews and more Orthodox ones, which is a political split, a cultural split, and definitely a religious split.
We're talking to Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's author of God on the Quad, How the Religious Colleges and the Missionary Generation Are Changing America. When we come back, what about all those rules at religious schools? You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about the huge rise in enrollment at America's religious colleges and universities with Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's author of God on the Quad. And Naomi, we spoke recently on Here and Now with the 24-year-old author of the book Smashed. It's about the really unbelievable excessive drinking on college campuses. And in light of that, I'm wondering, how do these religious schools treat issues like that?
The behavior on these colleges is so fundamentally different from at secular universities. These students go to college not to rebel against their parents. They want the rules. I mean, at Brigham Young, you sign on to not drink. You sign on for no caffeine, no premarital sex, no homosexual relationships, curfews. I mean, these are all very strictly regulated environments.
I'm imagining that there are a lot of young people who are craving that. I know of young people who've dropped out of regular colleges because they can't stand the climate of drinking and partying.
Well, I think that's definitely true. You know, a lot of these students, interestingly, are coming out of public school environments. And I was sort of interested in that. I figured, you know, maybe their parents were making them go to these schools and that was it. But, you know, for especially if you take like the Mormon kids, for instance, many of them are in a minority in their public school population. And they kind of long for an environment where every decision they have to make, they don't have to defend. They don't have to explain to their peers why they're not drinking to excess, why they're not engaging in premarital sex. And for them, the 4 years at Brigham Young is kind of an oasis where, you know, they're the norm.
I'm wondering, though, if these schools limit academic debate. I mean, you're supposed to, that's why you're supposed to go to college, to learn what other people's points of view are and to learn how to debate and exchange ideas. And you mentioned, for instance, that some Catholic students at some Catholic universities didn't want to hear about the Catholic Church scandal, for instance. It didn't affect them. Do you think these schools can, you know, isolate kids from ideas?
I think that that's definitely possible. And certainly with those Catholic schools, at the more conservative Orthodox Catholic schools, what you're getting is a sense that, you know, this is our part of the Catholic Church and that's somebody else's part of the Catholic Church, the people who are having the sex abuse scandals. And they don't really want to take responsibility for that in many ways. But you're right about isolating from the outside world in some ways, I think, and isolating from them from certain debates. And so, you know, the only thing I could sort of say in this defense, I think, you know, academic freedom is a discussion on a lot of secular college campuses, too, sort of what is in the realm of debate. You know, see Larry Summers here, you know,
right now,
just sort of looking at what you can discuss at a secular university. I think what the religious schools say is, you know, in some ways, I think they can have a more productive debate because many of them are starting from similar premises. So if you are, for instance, a Catholic who believes that life begins at conception, you know, there is a debate then going on at, say, the Ave Maria School of Law, which is a strongly Catholic law school in Michigan, that you can then sort of have a discussion about, well, what does that mean? What are the legal implications of that? Whereas I think at some secular law schools, if you said life begins at conception, that would be the end of the discussion. No one would want to hear you out any further than that.
Just a quick note. You say that the only Muslim post-secondary schools are a radical seminary near L.A., a couple of graduate programs in Virginia, and a school of 20 students focusing on computer science and Islam in Chicago. There are Muslim high schools, growing Muslim population. Do you think there's going to be a Muslim college?
Well, I hope so. But, you know, talking to various Muslim scholars in the U.S. right now, I don't see it happening anytime soon. You know, there are various reasons for this. You know, one of the reasons many of the religious schools in this country, particularly the Catholic and the Jewish schools, opened is that there were quotas at other schools on the number of Catholics and Jews who'd be allowed in. So the Jews and the Catholics felt, well, you know, we should have our own universities then. The Muslims are obviously doing fine at secular universities, and it's not like their admissions are restricted. But then I think you also sort of have to figure out what is important to the Muslim community in the United States right now. And I think it's a little unfortunate that they haven't placed higher education, you know, higher up on the list. If there were a Muslim university, I think it would create a great place for exploring these issues, which are so important now. You know, what does being a, you know, modern American Muslim mean today? Mm. You know, how can you take the ideas from sort of the pre-radicalization of Islam and sort of, you know, talk about how they interact with the Enlightenment and all those other questions?
Well, Naomi, we started by saying that, for instance, enrollment at the 100 member institutions of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, didn't know that was there were that many, jumped 60% between 90 and 2002. What do you think the far-reaching impact of these religious schools is?
Well, I think that if you look at the growth, and it's, you know, beyond evangelical schools to all these schools that I visited.
Enrollment is up?
Yes. At all of the different denominations, colleges and universities, enrollment seems to be going up. And the stronger the religious affiliation, it seems like the more enrollment is going up. So what is the effect? I think, you know, these students are really being pushed into the secular world by the administrations and faculty. They don't want these to be just ghettoizing institutions where students can escape the secular world. So I think that these students are essentially going into their professions, whether it be law or journalism, medicine, with a real sense of vocation. They really have a set of kind of ethical guidelines that they feel guides them in their behavior, in their job, in their community, in their government institutions, in the way they interact with their family. And so I think, you know, they could really sort of breed a change in a lot of secular culture. And in many ways, I think for the better. You know, they really feel a strong sense, for instance, that they need to practice business ethics. So there is an emphasis at business programs at these schools, for instance, you know, that they have a really a sense of responsibility to, you know, the stakeholders in a company. And they talk about that from a religious perspective. So I think, you know, in many ways, they could have a positive effect on a country that is, you know, plagued by, you know, Enrons and things like that.
Well, and that does sound great. But could they also contribute to what is increasingly seen as a divided America, one on one side of a split and one on the other, people who don't integrate and mix their different values?
Well, I think, you know, geographically speaking, these students are moving more and more into what we call blue America. I think in future elections, it is going to be hard to place these students, you know, in what we call flyover country. You know, they're not just staying in Kansas. Hmm. So I think that that's to start with. The other thing, you know, as I was saying before about how they're not explicitly proselytizing, I think people are worried that if these students find themselves in the cubicle next to them, that they're going to be, you know, passing pamphlets under the door or, you know, coming over to ask them if they're ready to come to Jesus yet. And most of these graduates really see their responsibility as more like setting an example than just bringing everybody into their faith.
Naomi Schaefer-Riley, she is the author of God on the Quad, How the Religious Colleges and the Missionary Generation Are Changing America. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the internet bloggers. They brought down Dan Rather and fellow writer Jeff Gannon. Now one mainstream editor says work with them, not against them. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Martha Stewart will walk away from her jail cell in West Virginia as early as tomorrow and head to her farmhouse in New York, where she'll spend the next 5 months under house arrest, her felony lying about a stock trade. Stewart has had as many ups and downs recently as her company's stock. She stepped down as CEO during the scandal and is reportedly negotiating with the Securities and Exchange Commission to resume the title. It would be unusual for a former felon to be CEO of a public company, but there's no question, title or not, who's running the Martha Show. Robert Pasikoff is president of Brand Keys Incorporated. His company tracks brand name products. He's tracked Martha and her empire for several years, and he joins us on the line from his office in Manhattan. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Well, so first of all, how did you track Martha's products? What do you ask people, and how has she fared through all of this?
Well, we use a system that is a combination of psychological questions and then some direct inquiry questions. We ask people if they were Martha Stewart, would she have a large crowd of friends or a few close friends?
Hmm.
Would she be the master of ceremony or would she be part of the audience? Doing that allows us to get under the emotional radar and get reads regarding the kind of things people actually think about when they are buying products.
And obviously you've put a lot of thought into this as a science to it, but for instance, if they said she would sit in the audience, are they sidelining her?
Well, they may be. You have to look at the combination and permutation of responses that you get. And what it does is it gives us a single number, an index number, that we can attribute to brand strength.
Right.
So, for example, back in May of 2002, prior to any of the problems that Martha faced, her brand was rated 20, which made it one of the strongest brands that we had ever tracked in the history of brands.
And now when you say her brand, do you mean all things Martha?
Well, Martha Stewart is one of those rare brands that is 100% invested in a human being. There aren't many of them. Michael Jordan is one. Tiger Woods is another. And those, of course, are the most fragile.
Right.
You can't turn around and blame a cartoon character or a logo.
Right. So that brings us to her low numbers.
Right. When she started to have the problems back in June of 2002, slowly but surely, the brand strength eroded until it was rated as one of the lowest brands that we'd ever seen. And that was, of course, at the time when she was found guilty of all five counts.
But then in late January, it had risen back up to 95, but we understand from your calculations that's still below an average score of 100.
Right. A benchmark is 100, and to be honest with you, what you really need is about a 106 or a 107 to be in a real profit range. The company has a way to go. The metrics that we calculate track very, very closely with corporate profitability. And, of course, she hasn't had any profits to report for the past 9 quarters.
But now there's going to be wall-to-wall coverage of a 20-pound lighter Martha Stewart leaving prison. She's going to tape 2 television series for NBC, a daytime home program, and The Apprentice, Martha Stewart, sort of a version of the Donald Trump show. And Kmart and Sears are merging, so her Kmart clothing line has a much bigger audience to reach. It would seem as if things are looking pretty hunky-dory for her company.
On the image side, that's certainly true. The 5 months in prison and the 20 pounds lighter provides a lot of closure and contrition for a consumer audience that was looking for just that, as well as some smoothing of the rough edges of the image that people saw during the year plus of the trial.
Right. The jail time seemed to have humanized her for many people. She taught other prisoners yoga. She helped them write to their families. Undoubtedly, all of that is going to be part of that, as you call it, contrition and closure that consumers need. But are you saying that that's not going to be enough?
Well, we tend to take a more business-like point of view. I mean, image is important, of course. I understand that there are lots of people, myself included for that matter, who feel that there were far more desperate and villainous people that should have been put in jail. But having said that, there's a reality to the marketplace, and the reality falls into 2 categories. One is that her image and the products that she sold was not entirely based on being creative, on being well-made, on being a complete palette of autumnal colors, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of it, but there were aspects that involved brand trust, open and honest communications, ethical business standards, as well as aspects of being nice, just plain being nice, not being mean-spirited.
The good things.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And those aspects of trust and the aspects of the good things that were totally eroded over the period of time that she was under the spotlight, day in and day out.
And any goodwill people have to her may not translate. Last week, her company's stock value jumped 225%, but at the same time, Martha Stewart Living OmniMedia announced a record loss of $60 million in 2004, nearly 10 times the loss of 2003.
That's right. And so what happened was when the trust disappeared, so did the readers, so did the buyers. The explanation is that the only thing that changed was the status of the brand, which was Martha herself.
Well, you know, Robert Pasikoff, a lot of people on Wall Street have tried to have second, third, fourth acts. How closely is the street watching this attempt to have another, you know, chapter in her life? And what are the bets? What are the odds?
Well, you know, you have to look at the woman. I mean, the situation is that the environment's changed. Consumers have moved on. People have discovered that Chris Madden sheets are exactly the same as Martha Stewart sheets in terms of thread count and color range and pricing, as have advertisers who discovered that there were plenty of acceptable alternatives to Martha Stewart Living, particularly since she had lost so many of her readers. So in that environment, you're looking at a brand that once held the high ground, now either being out on the plains with everyone else or maybe even being in a valley. But when you look at Martha Stewart, the woman, and you realize that whether you like her or you hate her, put all that image stuff aside, what you recognize is she built a category, she built an empire, she became an icon for this, albeit now a tarnished icon, and you got to place your bets that something's going on in her head over the 5 months that she's been away, thinking about what can she create, what can she diversify. I wouldn't count her out.
Robert Pasikoff is president of Brand Keys Incorporated, a company that looks at customer loyalty to brand names. Robert, thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Still to come, remembering the old theater organs that used to provide the soundtrack to silent films. You're listening to Here and Now. A study conducted at the University of North Carolina finds that 56% of the players in the National Football League are obese. The study appears in the current issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Dr. Arthur Roberts, a retired heart surgeon and former pro quarterback, has called the increasing size of pro football players a major concern. So he asked Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, to talk to Dr. Roberts about the science behind the study.
As always, it's hard to objectively characterize obesity in any population, particularly in NFL football players. My understanding was that the weight and height of the individual players was placed in a website that was associated with the NFL. Who knows how those heights and weights were obtained, or how stringently controlled and accurate these weights were, since they were not determined by the study investigators. There's no correlations with other parameters like lean body mass, percentage body fat, and other cardiovascular-related risk factors.
These concerns make it sound as if you don't really set much store by this report.
Having been in cardiology and heart surgery myself, and having been an ex-NFL football player, I've seen a lot in the medical world, and it's easy to make statements to talk about anecdotal situations, but it's harder to be scientific and be accurate and controlled and balanced in your comments when it comes to health. And that's what my group, the Living Heart Foundation, is now doing in conjunction with the NFLPA, the Players Association. We're taking the position that regardless, whenever we find cardiovascular risk factors in these players, we're beginning to have them identify the problems, seek help with their doctors, and minimize that risk.
Would you be in a position, or would your group be in a position, where you would say to an active player who weighs, say, 300 pounds, hey, it would be in your best self-interest to lose 30 pounds, even though the coaches were saying, hey, we want you to be big?
At this point in time, we as medical doctors would be in no position to say that, because we don't have data that compares NFL players to cardiovascular outcomes in the short and long term. It's fair to say that we're all concerned, but until we have collected enough data over time where we can demonstrate that there is adverse effects on cardiovascular health, we can't be certain.
How much bigger are players now than they were when you were playing in the 60s?
Clearly in the 60s, it was rare to have a 300-pound player. Currently, there's 300-plus or more than 20% of players that weigh more than 300 pounds. And this is reflected mostly in the offensive and defensive linemen. And it's such players of really large body size that might carry the brunt of cardiovascular consequences.
What do you think the schedule is likely to be as far as your study or other studies producing results that would make possible some definitive conclusions?
We are presenting a mini symposium. We have members of the Living Heart Foundation faculty and other noted doctors that have done studies related to NFL cardiovascular health. So we're beginning that process in just a few days. However, what I've learned in doing these player screenings over the past year and a half is that we're learning, but I have more questions than I have answers at this point in time. So we need more players and a longer period of time to really have a good handle on cardiovascular outcomes.
Dr. Roberts, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Dr. Arthur Roberts played with the Cleveland Browns and the Miami Dolphins in the 60s. He's now with the Living Heart Foundation, and he spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It used to be that every small theater across America had an organ. And the musicians who played those organs improvised the music and sound effects while silent movies played, becoming local, even national, celebrities. Well, theater organists went the way of silent films, but some of the theater organs survived. Here Now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Ohio musician Clark Wilson at a restored theater organ at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, to ask, to start, what's the difference between a church organ and a theater organ?
What you really need to remember is the similarities stop past the fact that both instruments have keyboards, pipes, and they're operated by air. That's where the similarities ended. The theater organ was designed, they were called back in the 19-teens and the 20s when they built them, as the nameplate says, unit orchestra. They were put in theaters around the country to take the places of orchestras to accompany silent films, and so you could have anything at your command. They actually were the world's original synthesizer, shall we say. And so you had different families of tone. You had the brass, the trumpets, and the tubas. You did have church organ sounds in them. Some of the early organs, if you hit a button, it set off a lightning display in the theater. Bird whistles, fire sirens, fire gongs, train whistles, boat whistles, you name it.
Does this have any of that?
This has some of that. There are some tuned sleigh bells. And, of course, chimes. And I can show you very quickly around these different pipes that we talked about, the fanfare trumpets, or maybe the tuba. That pipe is 16 feet long, as opposed to these little pipes that are about a half inch long. And a couple of different things like the orchestral oboe sounded like this. And even a funnier little oriental reed called the kanura.
There's so much kooky stuff.
Well, the fun stuff's just beginning.
This is actually connected to a piano in the corner of the room.
Piano. There is a real piano in these organs as part of the percussion department. The marimba harp. Real xylophone.
So that means up.
It's a real instrument.
There's a real
in the chambers. It's a real wood hammer, wood mallet and a bar instrument, just like you'd see in the orchestra. Same thing with the glockenspiel. And I meant to show you, too, the trap, what we call the traps, are up there as well.
Those are, I think I see them. They're like big flaps that you can control?
Exactly. The pipes always speak at the same volume, and I've got pedals down below. And when I open them, they open flaps or what we call swell shades in the wall. And the more of those open up, the more sound it lets out. So just like opening a big Venetian blind up there. But we've got in this trap section things like the snare drum.
And I take it that's an actual snare drum up there.
That is a real snare drum, real cymbals, real bass drum, real tom-tom, tambourine, castanets, wood block, triangle.
Hey, who needs an orchestra?
It's exactly it. Here it is, the unit orchestra.
So orchestra players must have hated this machine.
This replaced a lot of orchestras in theaters because in the 1920s, it was expensive to have a 20 or 30 or 40-piece orchestra for 5 shows a day, 7 days a week, just like it would be today. So hence these instruments were born. And really, as much as that, they were developed because it was found that one player at the console of one of these organs could closer follow a silent film for scoring than you could with a large group of musicians who couldn't all watch the screen and, of course, all had to do the same thing. You could change instantly from scene to scene on the theater organ. And then there were big, thick flutes, and they're not necessarily an imitation of anything, but you could imitate things. But if you turned on the typical theater organ tremulant or vibrato, they became a very romantic sound, and they were played in love scenes.
Where are these organs now?
All in all, the organs wound up sitting then, just sitting in the orchestra pits. Some of them went for scrap drives in World War II, selling off the vast amounts of metal that are in them and so on. Sometimes the orchestra pits were cemented over in wartime, so they could add 3 or 4 more rows of seats. The organ consoles were buried under concrete. They were thrown out in the back alley. People bought organs like this for $100. Into the 70s, they went into pizza restaurants, pizza parlors. That the organist sat up there and played requests from the patrons all night long, and they were very, very popular. Today, we as concert artists kind of grimace when somebody says, oh, the theater organ in a roller rink, because you think, oh, good heavens. And that's what so many people still think of. You know, they don't think of this as much of an art. Well, you just turn on the drums and away you go, thrump, boom. But that's not at all. These organs are capable of playing anything. People have said for years, well, it's not really a legitimate instrument because there's no music ever been written for the theater organ. There doesn't need to be any music written for the theater organ. Everything is playable on the theater organ. It's I think, the supreme making of music. Because most instruments, if you play the trumpet, you can only play one note at a time, unless there are people out there I don't know about. And you need your whole orchestra to make the finished piece of music. And with these theater organs, I'm a symphony conductor every time I sit down at one of these organs. The orchestra is mine. Well, you could do that on the piano, of course. You can play a finished composition. But this, and it's an all-encompassing sound. It was the original stereo because these organs were installed in lofts on both sides of the theaters and came at you from both directions, sometimes in the rear of the balcony as well. So it's the original stereo. It's the original surround sound. Even today, when I play one of these instruments for intermissions in the Ohio Theater in Columbus, a classic movie series that we do, we'll pick it up at intermission. And the movie's playing out, and you've got this surround sound, you've got Dolby stereo, you've got everything known to man. And when that fades out and the organ comes in, it's 10 times what you've just heard. It plays the building, is what happens. It moves the air in the room. It shakes your bones. It does the whole thing.
It rattles the floor. When I was standing here listening to you play, the floor vibrates.
It's something that you feel as well. And you see, that's impossible with electronic music today. These organs produce. So to me, this is the grandest instrument that's ever been conceived by the mind of man. The organ, in general, has always been called the king of instruments, and the theater organ is the monarch of the whole family.
Our interview with theater organist Clark Wilson was produced by Lynn Menegon. Okay, all skate, everybody. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.